Okay, we'll get started. So, welcome to this afternoon's Reform Scotland event. My name's Chris Deeran. I'm the think tank's director, and you're all very welcome today to what should be a fascinating and hopefully quite an inspiring discussion. If I could just ask everyone who isn't a participant on the panel to mute themselves, please, so we avoid any background noise. So this event came about by chance, really. I met with the three panelists entirely separately and unconnectedly over the summer just before, and found myself taken with the exciting projects that they've all developed and are beginning to deliver in Scotland's state schools. And it struck me through those conversations that, though in different ways, they're trying to do something quite similar, which is to boost the educational prospects and life chances of state-educated children, but also doing so from outside the system. And I think in the main, the focus is especially on those maybe from less privileged backgrounds whose aspirations may, through no fault of their own, be curtailed or not as high as they could be. You'll know, those who come to our events regularly, read our papers, that education is one of the founding passions of Reform Scotland. Our Commission on School Reform has existed almost as long as we have. It's fair to say, I think, that there's a general sense among our members, and further afield too, that the state school system is rather running its wheels at the moment, and that we could be both more ambitious for it and perhaps more demanding of it as well. So that's not to say there aren't great schools out there and brilliant teachers doing extraordinary things and changing lives, because of course there are. But there is a definite perception that perhaps we should be aspiring to more, to higher performance levels across the system, and certainly unlocking achievements that are more closely aligned to pupils' aptitude, perhaps rather than their economic background. I think it's fair to say that more could have been done at a government level to push this, more at a local authority level. There are people in government who admit as much to me. So we're constantly looking for the change makers in education and those people who are trying to push things on a bit. And it's interesting to me that there's so much going on outside the sector, leaning into the sector, and I think today was really a chance to talk about some of those projects and just see what's going on, and maybe take some ideas and inspiration from it. What I liked about today's guests, each of them in the conversation, was the sense of optimism and determination to make a difference where it's needed. So from different starting points, one in the charitable sector, one in academia, one in the independent sector, they're all working with pupils and teachers in educational areas that otherwise might be overlooked or be an afterthought or just unachievable due to resource restrictions in a busy school. But they're nonetheless vitally important to improving life chances. We're going to hear from each of them about their specific projects, and then I'll have a chat with them all. We'd also very much like to take your questions, so please do message me using the chat function on Zoom, and we'll get through as many as we can over the next hour. So let me introduce today's guests. I'll start with Victoria Vardy, who is Chief Executive of Gen Plus. Victoria leads a team that is helping students to develop crucial leadership and meta skills. Gen Plus is already working in schools across six Scottish local authority areas, and as far as I understand, aims to be in more than 2,000 schools by 2026-27. Next, Ian Munro is Rector of Dollar Academy, which is one of Scotland's most renowned independent schools. Under Ian's leadership, Dollar has created FIDA, which is the short form for the Futures Institute at Dollar Academy. That's an open access online learning platform which is being used by a growing number of Scotland's state schools. And its aim is to empower young people to learn in new ways through innovative projects that are rooted in the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And finally, we are joined by Ali Struthers, who is co-founder of the intriguing Taskmaster Education. This project stems from the Channel 4 comedy and entertainment and quiz show Taskmaster, which is on Channel 4. I'm sure most of you have seen it. And it uses that approach to inspire, engage, and teach young people. Ali is a law academic, and as I say, is co-founder of this. And she's also created School Tasking, which is an interactive university outreach project that enables young people to learn about interesting aspects of the law through tasks set in the style of Taskmaster. So, as I said, each of our guests is going to talk us through their project, hopefully telling us how it came about, its intentions, its impact, and their ambitions for it. And Victoria has agreed to lead us off. So, Victoria, thank you for joining us, and I'll hand over to you.
Thank you so much. I'm just going to share my screen if I can with you. I think that looks pretty small from my point of view. Let me just see if I can do something about that. see it now? Can you see all the interview, or is that the proper view of the PowerPoint?
That's that we can see. Thank you, Chris, for that kind introduction. And then your Learn, Lead, Thrive thing is on the left.
There you go. I'll play from the start. That's it. Good. Excellent. So, yes, thank you, Chris, for that kind of introduction. I had written that down because I'm pretty sure you would say something. GemPlus is a Scottish charity designed around teaching young people and their teachers all about meta skills. Now, we know that meta skills are these innate human, these timeless skills, and they come under the categories of self-management, social intelligence, innovation, and have been picked up by the 4.0 agenda, by the Scottish Government, are referenced in the Withers report, in the Hayward Review, the Ken Muir's report most recently by the World Economic Forum, as being absolutely vital for success in the next few years and crucial for our young people to learn. We know that they're facing huge uncertainty and change in the world that they're living in. We've got a rise in machine learning, we've got economic recession, we've had pandemics. So the challenge for educators is, how do we properly equip young people with the skills and competencies they need to navigate this complexity and get ready for the challenge that they're facing? But young people that also have this idea of perceived self-efficacy, they have a knowledge of their own skills and talents. They're able to articulate them. They're able to share them. They have the confidence around what they can achieve and what their futures might be like. And so to try and support young people in this journey, we have developed a meta skills program that follows pupils from what will be P6 at 9 years old, all the way up to S3 at 14 years old. And this is a foundational stage of learning where young people acquire the skills they need to be successful, not only academically, but in their lives and future worlds of work. So we have developed modules around 9 key meta skills. So in S3, they look at communication, initiative resilience, and then they look at the next skills as they move through S2. And then finally in S3, they culminate in a critical thinking, adaptability, and creativity project, which we've actually developed in line along with Daydream Believers, to look at this idea of rebranding failure and facing failure. Through all, they develop their personal journal, and there's a lot of self-assessment, self-reflection built in, which is sort of in tandem with kind of recommendations from the Hayward Review. But actually, the reason I wanted to share my screen was so I could share with you a short video we've made, and I'm a wee bit nervous that I haven't shared the sound, so I might need to. I'll try it, and then if you can't hear, I'll just reshare.
GemPlus is on a mission to unlock the potential in every classroom by harnessing the power of meta skills, those timeless skills that help you learn, think critically, solve problems, and work effectively with others. We are equipping learners and their leaders for positive outcomes in learning, life, and work. Developed by experienced educators and global experts, our world-leading GemPlus Learn program combines in-person teaching and interactive digital learning, seamlessly integrating into your school's curriculum. Aimed at 9 to 14-year-olds, this blended learning approach emphasizes innovation, collaboration, and play, while enabling pupils, teachers, and carers to easily track results and celebrate achievements. Through the GemPlus Teach program, we are transforming teacher professional development. The curated GemPlus Teach library of concise learning content is designed to support and energize our leaders of learning. Our goal is to help every pupil and teacher learn, lead, and thrive, and for every pupil to recognize their worth, identifying their own unique skills. Start your journey with us now.
So hot off the press. But this is what it looks like when the pupils log in. So it's a platform designed to be really engaging, to take the best practices from gaming. They have their avatar, they strive for digital badges, but it's not an e-learning course. The idea is that we want to resource teachers to use this as a tool in the classroom for teaching and engage young people using the best of technology has to offer. We've worked with UX designers and software people across the world, all to find solutions for Scottish education and lead them through what is an exciting program. It's very much focused on a toolkit. So how do we make better decisions using the ICE framework? Or how do we build our resilience using the SMS sleep mindset support? How do we tell a story more effectively? Tools for active listening. So it's very much a kind of toolkit of things, shared language, shared, you know, say to kids, I'll do that presentation, but think about how you communicate it. But how do they do that? You need to teach them the skills that they need. And then what's really nice about the other people here today, the Taskmaster and the US UN Sustainable Development Goals activities, is that they can then take this toolkit and practice it and apply it in different contexts. And we know that actually young people don't all have the same opportunities. And that's why this was designed very much in mind that we need to help young people learn these skills explicitly. We can't just expect them to pick it up in their football club or doing the school play, because they won't all have those same opportunities. They might be young carers. They might not be able to afford that. So how do we make sure that there's time in the core curriculum to develop these skills, get young people to be able to very confidently say, these are the things that I'm good at. School might be a quite a difficult environment for me. Might not feel like I'm a great success at maths and English, but look at the things that make me, that I'm a great communicator. I'm good at empathizing with other people. I'm building my leadership brand. I'm looking at my values, and I know how to make good decisions. So, and recognizing that, we built a journal through the course where they add reflections. It's a bit kind of blended vegetable style that's kind of stealthily done. And then they also do self-assessment, and the teachers can add to their report and add badges, and it's shared with parents to sort of celebrate the whole child beyond their academic achievements, to be able to recognize and celebrate that with young people. In parallel to this, we have a course for teachers, Gen Plus Teach, which is two things. It's a leadership learning library, which looks a bit like Netflix, with micro-learning content around skills and teaching standards, and a course developed with the University of Strathclyde Business School that takes the best of MBA and commercial learning and leadership, the big funding, to bring it to school and school educators. Because if we want schools to get better, we need to invest in our teachers. We need teachers to be getting better all the time. And it's a really important part that teachers feel valued and are coming on this journey and able to teach young people confidently about skills. And we've not been going very long. We've got 45 schools. And we have big ambitions to be available to every young person in Scotland within the next 5 years. So 45 schools this year, aiming for 100 next year. That's the trajectory. And we're very grateful to the pilot schools we work with that very much shape the programme. We're a team of teachers. We've worked with teachers and young people, and we're to really try and make it the very best we can. And we're continually learning and revisiting it. One of the new things we're bringing in is not just the S3 course, but the primary programme, looking to get a qualification for the young people doing it, working with the Robert Owen Centre for Educational Change to look at impact and assessment measures, and integrating AI, which is quite exciting. So when the pupils write down their journal entries or writing text, it gives them real-time feedback and marking and suggestions, you need to use a full stop, or could you think of another way to phrase that type of idea, which is really exciting how we bring the best to young people. But really, just to close, Gen Plus was based and funded by a business that really wanted to expand their business, but found they were short of really good leaders to drive the business forward in Scotland. And really, if we want better leaders for Scotland, we need to be thinking about how we educate our young people. We need to be developing young leaders for the future in innovative ways, innovative curriculum, really good investment in teacher training, so that these young people leave with the self-efficacy. They're equipped to take on the challenges, but they feel that they have this confidence that their future is, they can do anything, that they have the skills they need, and that they've had the support to get there. So that is our ambition. And we're excited about working with some really brilliant schools across Scotland. And I'm really hopeful about the future of Scottish education. There's lots to be done, as always, in every area, but there is some really great things happening across the Scottish education system. Thank you. I'll stop sharing now.
Thank you. That's great, Victoria. Thanks very much. I feel almost obligated to ask what on earth's going on with that teacher's shirt on the video. He looks like he had a problem painting the ceiling and things fell on him. Or should I ask where he got it so I can get one?
I can ask him. No, that's his own shirt. I've seen him wearing it more than once. So
it's a strong statement. It's a strong statement. Good for him. Okay, thank you for that. That was fascinating. As I said, very inspiring and exciting. I'll hand over now to Ian Munro, the director of Dollar Academy, who's going to tell us about FIDA. Ian, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Chris, for the introduction. I'm Ian Munro. I am the rector of Dollar Academy. I sort of run the charity that oversees Dollar Academy, and now also oversees this thing called FIDA. And I guess the two are very different. Dollar Academy is a 200-year-old independent school, and FIDA is an open access platform through which, educational platform through which we're now reaching thousands of young people in Scotland. So I thought I'd tell you a bit about why we decided to set this up and what it is and what our ambitions are for the future. Why did we set Feed It Up? I think back in 2019, we just really got a bit fed up with lots of people moaning about the state of Scottish education, but not doing anything about it. So we were frustrated by that. And we were also, I think, a wee bit frustrated by some of the other independent schools who were, I think, a bit lazy in their thinking and suggesting that they were really great anchor organizations for their local communities because they let people use their football pitches or the games hall once a week. And we just didn't really think that was good enough. So that was our motivation. We were frustrated. So the plan was to come up with this thing called FIDA. And this would be an open access school learning environment where the stuff that went on within it would look really different to what happens in classrooms throughout Scotland on a day-to-day basis. So we wouldn't have any exams. Instead, we would portfolio people's work as they went through the journey. The curriculum would be based around real-world challenges. So instead of arbitrary facts set by an education minister, we were going to talk to industry and academia and find out what problems were out there in Scotland and invite young people to develop solutions. Teachers were not going to be teachers like me in a shirt and tie. They were going to be real people from the real world like you out there. And also, we were going to not have any artificial age boundaries. So you could have a 15-year-old working with an 18-year-old. So back in, by now, 2020, we were really quite revved up about the idea of this Futures Institute. And then the pandemic came, which is a bit tricky, really, because my thinking then went from the kind of FIDA bit of the equation back to the Dollar Academy bit of the equation, where we had to take the curriculum and digitize it for all these young people who were learning from home. And I remember being a bit worried about that because, some of my colleagues are very tech savvy and some of them, well, back then, I don't know, I wasn't really sure if they could use their email, or maybe that's just because they never replied to my emails, but there was a huge variation in the kind of digital literacy of my colleagues. But it actually turned out that at Dollar, we were pretty good at the online thing. So what we decided to do in that moment was to start putting traditional SQA courses online for free for young people throughout Scotland to study. And we looked at shortage subjects. So these are subjects that a lot of young people throughout Scotland want to study, but they're not an offer in their school. And and for us, certainly the most successful was higher politics, which we put online. And lots of young folks signed up to it, did the online learning thing, got great grades at the end of it, and it was a success. And that was quite an important moment for FIDA because we thought, well, if we can do the kind of traditional courses online successfully, how about if we go back to that idea of having no exams, online portfolio, and start building some new next generation courses with industry and academic partners and route each one in one of the UN Sustainability Development Goals. So that's what we did. We made partnerships with Highland Spring, Johnson's of Elgin, Barrett Holmes, University of Cambridge. And we asked these guys to develop courses with us that young people could study, some remotely and some in person. And this could be to do things like develop robots to pull plastics out of the oceans, or to create a piece of physical theatre that highlighted homelessness in the downtown urban environment. With Johnson's of Elgin, it was about trying to solve some of the sustainability challenges associated with making clothes. And we launched 17 of these courses on the online platform. And I always remember about a week after we launched these courses, talking to the team and saying, right, how's it going? How many people have signed up from throughout Scotland, or maybe even the world? And the answer came back, 6. Now, that was a bit depressing at the time, but I remember saying to the team, but that's 6 people's lives who we might have changed. This is good. But 6 quickly became 12, 24, 48. You get the story. And lots of young people throughout the country started signing up to take these co-branded courses between FIDA and industry partners. Education Scotland's got hold of it and asked if they could push these courses out to all the schools in the country in the run up to COP26, which we said, yeah, of course. SQA were quite interested in accrediting these courses. We said, that's a kind offer, but we're actually trying to disrupt this space a bit, so we're not going to jump on board with you. Victoria mentioned some of the more, I guess, the policy piece around the Hayward Review and Ken Muir's review, putting learners at the centre. These guys got hold of FIDA. Ken Muir actually suggested that it answered most of the recommendations in his report and called upon Scottish Government to back it. And basically things started going really well for us. We find ourselves in the position now where thousands of young people throughout Scotland do study FIDA courses. We work directly with over 50 local state schools who not only use this content in their schools, but now also help us develop the content with us collaboratively. We've got a steering group which is made up of maybe one or two people from Dollar, and then lots and lots of colleagues from local authorities, ranging all the way from Shetland down to Dumfries. We're also working with one Scottish university to directly accredit these courses. So if you're a young person and you do want to go to university, but maybe you don't want to do hires, or as is sadly the case in some schools, you can't do a wide enough range of hires to get to university. And if you did some of these FIDA courses, this leading Scottish university will accredit them and let you come directly in. So we're quite excited about that, because that's quite a big kind of systemic change. Just to finish up, I guess, back in the beginning, I kind of spoke about FIDA being a thing that would take place in a kind of living, breathing, physical environment, which was the plan before the pandemic. But at this stage now, with the sort of the momentum behind the project, we are going back to trying to create a physical home for FIDA. And we're quite lucky in that we've got a good relationship. FIDA has a good relationship with Andrew Wally, who's the chap who designed the Eden project. And you know, that's the next step in our journey. We've just got planning for that. So we're hoping to build this new hub for world-class excellence in teaching and learning and a kind of a new future of Scottish education, a home for it here in Dollar. So Chris, I hope that's helpful.
That's wonderful, Ian. Thanks so much. And it's fascinating to hear about how quickly it's expanded and how many children you're reaching now, and we'll come back and talk a bit more about that shortly. But finally, we'll move on to Ali Struthers, who's bringing the celebrity, the sort of glitter of showbiz to this afternoon's conversation. So Ali set up Taskmaster Education and School Tasking, and Ali, I'll just leave you to tell us about that now.
Thanks, Chris. I'm very sorry I missed the whole of the introduction because my internet decided to play up. It's welcome week. It's day two. I think all the students have all of a sudden managed to get online and have crashed the campus. So I'm tethered to my phone, and I do apologise if I drop out at any point. I've also got fresher's flu, so I apologise if I burst into some sort of coughing fit at any point. I've got my Lemsip in my giant cup, so we should be okay. So thanks very much, Chris, for having me. And I, as I say, I'm sorry I missed the introduction, so I'll just start at the beginning as if you haven't said anything, because I'm not sure what you've said about School Tasking. So first of all, I'm Ali Struthers. As you said, I'm an associate professor at Warwick Law School. I'm obviously not from this part of the world. I'm originally Scottish, so I'm sort of feel a great affinity for the Scottish education system. And I guess where School Tasking started was, I have a role in the law school of director of widening participation. So that's my kind of academic administrative role. And I was looking for a way to make our outreach with primary school kids more fun, because I firmly believe that you have to start outreach work with primary school kids, you know, with the youngest kids, get them into the mindset of thinking, of course I can go to university, before they believe anything different. I was a big Taskmaster fan myself and thought, well, isn't this a beautiful vehicle for education? So from that, and from some wonderful discussions with Lindsay Jack, who's here today, we spitballed some ideas and we came up with this concept of School Tasking. So School Tasking essentially is taking the format of Taskmaster. For those of you who don't know what Taskmaster is, it's essentially a program where five comedians do nonsense tasks for no good reason and get judged on their their task efforts by Greg Davies, who is the taskmaster. The show was created by Alex Horn, who's a comedian, who's very closely involved in school tasking, and is just a wonderful human being. But we thought this element of doing a task that is related to their learning and being judged on that task gave Outreach a sort of fun element of competition. It gave it a bit of a point for the kids. And I think nowadays we think kids can't cope with competition, but they love the aspect of kind of gentle, supportive, inclusive competition. So the way that school tasking runs, I piloted it at Warwick Law School in 2021-22 in that academic year, where a small staff team were going out to schools and running the sessions. So there are four sessions of an hour and a half each in our local widening participation primary schools. That's higher than average free school meals and or lower than average school progress scores. We would go in, we'd teach them about an area of law for an hour or so, and then they do a task based on that learning. And the teaching itself is interactive. It's based on them doing activities. It's based on them honing skills of creativity, lateral thinking, problem solving, teamwork. We're aiming really to, they don't need to know about law. It's not on the curriculum. What they benefit from is the chance to kind of practice these wonderful skills that are associated with law and being a lawyer. So we go in, we do the sessions, and then the winning team from each of our schools was going to come to us at the school tasking final, which was a chance for them to come onto campus and get a bit of a glimpse of university life. So the next year we piloted it, which was this academic year, the sessions themselves are run by our students, which is amazing. And Lindsay ran it at Edinburgh this year, again, with a student team. So the students going in, running the sessions. And the kids love it because they're more interested in students than they are in fuddy-duddies like us. The students are far more engaging to them. So it's wonderful that school tasking keeps on growing. We now have 30 universities across the UK that are taking part. So it's become this giant, it takes over my life essentially, but it's become this huge thing. The universities that are all taking part work in regional partnerships. So there are five regions in the mainland UK, and then Ireland has just joined as a separate region. And the kids will all compete against, I suppose, their classmates, because they're all in teams. They'll compete against other classes in their school. They'll compete against other schools in their university area, and they'll be competing against other teams within the region. The ones that then win the regional finals that are held in each of the university partnership regions will come down to Warwick at our expense. We're paying for all the kids to come down. They'll come down to Warwick and they'll get to take part in a champion of champions, to use Taskmaster language for any of you who've seen Taskmaster, a champion of champions final, which is going to be really, really fun. It's just going to be a day where they get to have fun and feel like they are, you know, the bee's knees. We've got the big graduation venue at Warwick, so they're going to get to do the final there. Alex Horn is coming. He's very involved in school tasking. He's absolutely brilliant. So that's what school tasking is, and it's a lot of fun. And we, you know, universities are joining daily. I've had another one joining just this morning, which is very exciting. But there is a kind of serious point to it. I think all the universities are getting involved because it's a glimmer of joy in an otherwise hopeless world/country. I think people just embrace the joy, the nonsense, the fact that the kids are so enthusiastic about it. But alongside the joy and the nonsense, there is a serious point to it, because we are gathering data. We're working with the Brilliant Club, who are a fantastic charity that do a lot of WP work. They get PhD students going into schools and teaching kids, and they do a lot of evaluation. So we've brought the Brilliant Club on board, and they are going to be working with us to evaluate standardized data from all the universities that are taking part. That's almost 6,000 kids. So it's the largest outreach project that the Brilliant Club are aware of as an inter-university collaboration, which is very exciting. And we're asking in those evaluation forms, so the kids complete pre and post evaluation forms, we're trying to gauge what they know about university, What do they think about university? Who can go to university? What words do they associate with university at the start and the end of the project? We're also evaluating what they know about law at the start and the end of the project. So again, what is a lawyer? What does a lawyer do? What do you know about law? And then the production company are interested in, have they seen Taskmaster at the start and the end of the project? But that's slightly less important from an outreach point of view. So we're going to have that analysis, tracking that through all the university partners, and the Brilliant Club will produce these two things. And then alongside that, I'm doing some research of my own into the very first task that they do in school tasking is draw the law. So before we teach them anything, we get them to draw the law to see what they think the law is. And of course, they think it's murder and robbery and policemen and jail cells. We get them then to do it again at the end of the project as an activity. And I'm looking at and analysing the difference between those drawings just to see if we're disrupting their thinking about what law is and who it's for. And we see a change. We see a wonderful change. They start to introduce human rights concepts from civil law. We get snails and bottles, we get Jaffa cakes. We see far fewer gavels. And if that's all we achieve, then my work here is done. And then I get them a year later to draw the law again, just to see if they're retaining any of that knowledge, which they are, and it's wonderful. So I think in a nutshell, what we're trying to do through school tasking is bring some joy into outreach work, get kids really enthusiastic and engaged, get them onto university campuses across the country, and just inspire them, not necessarily to study law, though it would be great if they do, but just to consider university as an option for them, and something that if that's the path they choose, then the door will hopefully be open to them. I think I'm out of my allocated time, Chris, so I'll stop talking, but thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Ali. I do have just one question for you that occurs, and I'm sure it's occurred to others. This is working with law at the moment. It seems ripe to be expanded into almost any other area of study you could imagine. Is that something that you're looking at, something that might happen?
Oh, I mean, I'd love to, but I am one person and I'm essentially project managing 30 universities. So at the moment, it's tricky to expand it. But I have had so much interest in from across, you know, STEM subjects, modern languages, anything you can think of, you could use this as a vehicle for. People often say to me, what's the connection between law and Taskmaster? And Taskmaster is all about law. It's all about interpretation. It's about trying to subvert the wording of an instruction. It's about, you know, you get these beautiful debates in Taskmaster when people are arguing about what a word means, and it could be playing out in a courtroom. So it's natural that it sits within law because it's about rules and interpreting rules and trying to get around rules. But like you say, I mean, it could be used for almost any discipline. And actually we do a lot. So I'm seconded for 2 days a week to Avalon, who are the production company that make Taskmaster, to do commercial Taskmaster stuff. So we have just rolled out Taskmaster clubs actually across the country, and there we get to have a lot more fun with the tasks we do because they can fit within any curriculum area. They're not all linked to the curriculum, but we try to get some in there that will fit more within traditional curriculum areas. So design and technology and art and science and all these things. So I think we get our creative outlet for tasks beyond law in other ways, but it would be wonderful if school tasking did become something across disciplines. It's just, I have
more hands. Yes, no, that's great. Thank you for that. And I hope everyone watching and listening is taking as much inspiration from these three people in the project as I have. I find myself inspired all over again and excited for the potential of this. One of the things I wanted to ask you, and it's an open question really, maybe start with you though, Victoria. I'm interested how easy it was to gain access to state schools for your project, because there is, I guess, fairly or unfairly, the perception that the sector can be a bit defensive about letting in outside actors and voices, and that, you know, that there is a certain way of doing things and they don't really want that disrupted. What was your experience of that, and how did you go about getting into the schools, and have some local authorities been more open than others? What's the general experience been?
Well, schools are busy places, so there's always this kind of idea of, like, do we have enough time to do something else? But actually, we've worked and And similarly with the other people on the panel, that they're really meeting a need that schools know that they have. I used to be a teacher. I know that young people need these skills. I know that they need excitement and innovation in their curriculums and other ways to recognize all their strengths. So teachers are really, they put learners at the center. So if there's something that comes across their path that actually is going to be great for the young people, actually we found there's a real appetite to do that. And we have had this period post-pandemic where there's kind of a period of reflection. There's been a lot of reviews and people are looking for different ways to approach education and be more expansive in their thinking. Now that doesn't apply to everybody, but there has been some really great people we've had the benefit of working with. I asked my colleague about this because it started before I joined, but the smaller local authorities like Dundee, East Renfrewshire were good examples of where there's good collaboration between the local authority and their schools and the relationship with the schools and Education Scotland. So they've been a real great place. Like Morgan Academy in Dundee were one of our pilot schools that came on board really early on when we didn't really have very much learning material to share with them, but really have come on this journey with us and built the resources with us and provided the pupil focus groups and young people's committees to try and drive forward that. So they've been very much collaborative with the local authorities and schools to get the product where get the platform and the lessons to where they are. So there's been quite a lot of reception for that. But there are a lot of people, when you work with local authorities, you've got to get permission from the school, permission from the local authorities. There's quite a lot of people to say no, and quite a lot of people you need to get to say yes and to sign various bits of paper. So it's not the fastest. Mm-hmm. And there's that sort of, you know, to start 12 months in advance of when we want to be in the schools to make sure everything's in place. But there is a passion within a lot of educators for change and for these innovations, but it isn't an easy, I wouldn't say it's the most straightforward process always, but we are getting there and found that a lot of schools have approached us rather than us approaching schools looking for ways to implement a skills curriculum or skills framework in their schools and a real recognition of that need. And similarly with other ways to engage young people.
And I suspect success breeds success. So the more schools you're in and the more people hear about it, maybe the more open other places are to it. Ian, you're coming from the big bad independent sector into the state sector, you know, and there are views and politics and aspects of society where, you know, you guys are, in a sense, the bad guys. What did you find when you were approaching, I guess, the state sector and saying, look, we want to help, we've got this capacity, we've got these ideas, and, you know, we want to be good, we want to do this for the sake of Scottish education system, Scottish economy, etc.?
Well, I think as the bad guys in some sectors, we probably had a bit more work to do than others. I mean, what Victoria is saying about there being some really agile, creative schools and local authorities, I completely recognize that as well. So we made some new friends quite easily, but equally there were some local authorities and schools where we had to work really hard. And it was actually an interesting journey because it was about building a relationship and helping people understand that behind this 200-year-old independent school, there is a charity that runs a school but also wants to do other stuff. And I think those were interesting discussions, and they've been really fruitful, and we've made lots of new pals out of this. I think also in our kind of partnership journey, maybe because we were starting as the bad guys and we thought we'd have work to do, we, you know, I had this kind of beautiful idea as a disruptor. If we just built this cool thing, it would just work, right? And everyone would want to do it. And then along the way, you know, some of the team said, yeah, but if we could hook Education Scotland on this, if we could actually try and get in amongst government, we might be able to influence policy a little bit. So that's been part of our strategy too. And it certainly helped, I think, our credibility when Education Scotland, before they were about to be blown up at least, when they got hold of these courses and started pushing them into local schools. So I think that kind of gave colleagues and local authorities, it kind of granted permission. It kind of, they thought, right, if it's badged with this, we should do it because we might be measured on it. So yeah, it's been an interesting journey in terms of making new pals. But just again, like Victoria's project, you know, when people start talking about it and there's choice and people start voting with their feet, then you start building momentum quite quickly.
And you, in your introduction, you mentioned the fact that, that Dollar's trying to roll this out and almost lead the way for independent schools to be more active, not just across your community in Clackmannanshire, but across Scotland. And you said that some schools have probably not gone as far as others. We know, and I think at some point we should do a different event on this, but we know that there are issues facing the independent sector. You know, the Labour Party, if it gets in government, Westminster's talking about VAT on private schools. There's suggestions the SNP are looking at charitable status again. Is this the kind of thing that more independent schools should be proactively doing to show their social use, if you like? I mean, because, you know, not every private school, or independent school, should say, is an Eton or a Westminster with, you know, hugely deep pockets. But nevertheless, you know, they tend to have better facilities. They have maybe an interesting group of teachers that aren't necessarily fitting the traditional model. They often have grounds that, you know, so there's just stuff there that you think a lot more could be done, probably a bit more a dynamic in the technological sphere as well. So is this something that you think would go maybe some of the way to addressing the concern out there that it's still too exclusive and not socially active enough?
Yes. I mean, I think the kind of sad thing for FIDA is that, I mean, this way of thinking was kind of started before VAT on fees, or before that, you know, before the whole charitable status thing ramped up again. And I think I've largely worked in independent schools, and a great beauty of them is that we are independent. So, you know, if we have the ability to make big curriculum changes, set things up like this, and just because it's a good thing to do, and you can try and raise lots of people up, you know, try and raise the system up from within. And it's kind of weird to have a high performing industry in a country and then for the government to tank it. But I mean, that's kind of, yeah, that's where we are. And I understand some of the reasons for that. So yeah, I think, you know, for Dollar, it was more about reimagining what it means to be an educational charity back in 2019. But moving forward, you know, if there is going to be central intervention to try and make schools like Dollar or Eton or Harrow, which are very different schools, as you pointed out, but if there's going to be intervention to make them more palatable, it should go beyond, yeah, share your facilities, give away 2 bursary places a year. And one of the nice things through FIDA is that we've shown this kind of scalable way of sharing what seems to be good practice. So I think there's really interesting opportunities for a government to explore around building partnerships and taxing independent schools in different ways other than just sticking VAT on fees, which won't get rid of the sector. It'll just make it more elitist. So that, you know. But yeah, it'd be a really good discussion for another day.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that you all have in common is perhaps the use of technology. And we know that technology is changing education. We know that it will change it considerably in the future. And perhaps we're not quite sure yet just how far that will go. But it's also changing the skills that are needed in the workplace. It's changing what universities have to do. What's the potential for technology in education? Ali, are you using education quite as much as the other two, or is it more the physical presence? I know that you sometimes get Alex Horn coming in digitally to sort of thrill the kids, but what do you see in terms of the technological outreach?
I mean, so we're not using tech in quite the same way. We almost want the face-to-face interactions more than we want the kids to be using tech for this particular project, because they're inspired by our students. You know, our students go in, a lot of our students that are, or certainly my project team, they're first generation students themselves. They go in, they say, you know, I'm first in my family to go to university. They have those informal discussions with the kids. We do use, I mean, we use tech particularly from the perspective of keeping costs down, which I think is great for getting universities involved. The first year that I piloted School Tasking, I gave the kids a workbook for every session that we went and did, because I had the budget to do that. But when I was considering the national rollout of the project, in order to keep costs down, which is so important, particularly for this kind of outreach project, which is usually funded from a widening participation budget, of which universities don't throw money at with gay abandon, shall we say. They tend to be stretched budgets already. So therefore, in order to get as many universities able to take part in the project as possible, we make a lot of it tech-based in the sense that we'll put activities that on PowerPoint slides instead of having physical resources. As you say, Alex does videos for us. He sets tasks for us. They're video-based and the kids love that because they get to know Alex and they get to, you know, they feel like he's part of the project. And then, yeah, he live streamed into our previous finals and the kids all got to ask him a question. So, I mean, the wonder of live streaming has made the world a much smaller place, and Alex can just take an hour out of his filming day at the Taskmaster House to come and answer the kids' questions, but they feel like they've had this really exciting experience because they've got to ask Alex a question. And so I think tech does play a role for us, but we're not tech-based, I think, in the same way that the other two speakers are. We're more using tech to make this project as accessible as possible for all universities that want to get involved, really.
Okay, and Victoria, you're pretty whizzy when it comes to the digital aspect of what you're doing, and there is an AI element in your program. I think it's open source. You're iterating constantly, improving it, taking account of feedback, and the rest of it. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean we're fully using tech. That's been, you know, we pushed forward. I was a teacher during the lockdowns and the pandemic, and we moved, like Dollar did, to kids on computers, and there's so many benefits that I'm so excited about where tech can take education. I used to teach geography, and I want kids to go on VR field trips all across the world from, you know, put their headset on, be taught by the leading volcanologist while peering over a volcano. There is, and I know that in some schools down south, they're using a sort of, you know, a computer generated Henry VIII, who is answering questions in real time using like kind of ChatGPT kind of technology. So the kids would ask some questions about why he made those decisions or why he did that, and he would answer back. So the type of learning experience children can have and the opportunities, their virtual worlds are really expanding. So it's how do we make sure that it's not the kids that have the most resources at the best schools that can take full advantage of that, and other kids are left behind that don't have an access to a device or don't have enough, you know, money on their phone to access the resources. So that's a real challenge, I think. And the government has a one-to-one device policy, but how well is that rolled out? How integrated is that in the school? Do the kids, you know, I'm working in Morgan and their kids sit down, they get the computer out and we start. Some other schools, it's like, oh, I can't find a laptop. I've got one. It's not quite charged. Or can I use it on my phone? And they're losing 5 minutes of lesson time. So we haven't quite made a very smooth transition to using technology in a more routine basis. And like Ali said, there is so much value in not being on a screen all the time. So it's getting the right balance, but using tech to share resources and democratize the learning experience with more young people to be able to take advantage of, you know, I can't imagine how great it would be to stand in front of a class of 30 young people, give them an essay question and for them to start writing and get marked in real time rather than waiting for me to hand back their marking 3 days later, which they're not going to pay any attention to. So there's real excitement and possibility, but actually getting the hardware on the ground and in classrooms and available to everyone is a real challenge that we're facing, and I'm anxious about the inequity. We're excited about the possibilities, but there is a wee anxiety for me on that as well.
And on the inequity, and if anyone does have a question, we haven't had many come in, so if you do, please send them now. We've got about 10 minutes left, so it'd be good to get some feedback and some questions from the audience. I think that your projects are really connected because they are focused, as I said at the start, on maybe not the whole time, but certainly the majority of it, on connecting with children who might come from less privileged backgrounds, might have less lower aspirations or lack of basic skills through no fault of their own, who might have all the talent in the world but don't maybe have the privileges that some others do. What kind of impact do you feel you're having there, and can we have an impact on scale in the state system in this way? It's something that we've been talking about for a long time, about how we improve the performance of children who have all the ability, or maybe not as academically able, but finding other ways for them to thrive. How much of an impact do you three feel that you're able to have? Is it around the margins? Should it be something that is connected up to a broader program in the state education system that is really fiercely going at this stuff? It's quite a big question. Maybe it's too big a question, but Ian, I'd maybe let you start.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think scale and impact can be measured in different ways with different magnitudes. For example, we have 30 kids, many of which from SIM D1 backgrounds on campus here today, working with Barrett Homes on a week-long project where they're looking at old housing stock and how it can be, it's a big problem in the UK, very old housing stock, not very eco-friendly, how it can be reimagined and kind of upcycled to make it more more eco-friendly. And for some of those kids, they'll go on and do placements, work experience, internships with Barrett. So for those 30 kids, their outcomes, life chances, you know, maybe improved in a wee bit. And it's a bit like me at the beginning was saying, well, we had those six kids and their lives might change. I think that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And as sometimes I say to the team here, it's not really FIDA's job to, you know, solve all the problems that we have with the education system in the country, but perhaps it is our job to provide a beacon project, which I think we're doing, and the other guys are doing as well, and demonstrating a different way of doing things, and then pushing that really hard, and trying to make, you know, trying to have a constructive and collaborative relationship with government and policymakers, and saying this is something that can be scaled up, it can be rolled out. You'll need to do teacher training differently. It'll need funding, but just showing that there are different ways of doing it. And I think we've got to keep trying because education is just so important.
Mm-hmm. And Ali, I know from a previous conversation we've had that as well as demystifying the law for some of the people, you're also trying to reach kids to say to them, well, the law might be for you. You might not be from the kind of traditional background that the lawyers have come from, but actually we want to open that door for you. How are you finding the response to that? Is it quite a hard sort of nut to crack to persuade kids that actually this might be something for them, this kind of upper middle class sort of traditional profession?
I don't think so. I mean, the kids are so enthusiastic about everything that we do with them. And actually, I just gave a welcome talk to our new undergraduates, and I was asked to give them one piece of advice. And my piece of advice to our new undergraduate cohort coming in was, don't ever lose the creativity that you had as a primary school child, because working with the primary school kids in School Tasking, they are so much more sort of open to different interpretations of law and exciting ways of thinking about law than my undergraduates are. My undergraduates come in with this fixed idea that there must be a right answer in the law. What does the lecturer want me to say? So actually, I think the kids, if you can enthuse them with that creativity, if you can make, and I tell them, I say to them, you guys are much better at law than my undergraduates. And they love it because they feel like, well, we must be really good at this. And they genuinely are. They blow me away with their critical thinking, with their lateral thinking, you know, thinking about law in really creative ways, in ways that even sometimes I think that probably should have been in the judgment, what that kid just said. So I think it's just, we don't necessarily, like as I said in the talk, we're not there to sort of cajole them into studying law. That's not really, the point is to introduce them to a university subject in a fun, engaging way that will just sow the seed of, oh, university can be really fun. And it kind of leads on a little bit to the impact question as well, Chris, in that I mentioned in this, in response to the, or I mentioned in the presentation about data analysis, and that we're looking at the data and how the data is showing what kids think about university and think about law. But equally, and I'm going to hand over to Lindsay for this point, because she tells this so beautifully. School Tasking is so inclusive, and it speaks to the talents of all the children, that we get such rich personal feedback and stories. And Lindsay and I have co-presented where I've been talking about data and Lindsay's been talking about not data. So I'm going to hand over to Lindsay for just a second to talk about
your
experience of the
Let's have it, Lindsay.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a rerun of our talk we did in Oxford in summer, data and undata, where, yes, of course, we need the data. We need to know the scale of a problem in order to know what to do to solve it, how to solve it, and so that we can measure when we have actually begun to solve that problem. So first of all, I think around language, I wouldn't say we need to raise anyone's aspirations. I've never seen a young person not achieve their dreams because they didn't aspire hard enough. If they're not getting somewhere, that's on society, that's not on them. And there's an incredible amount of work going on in the legal profession and in the widening participation sphere to make sure that everyone has that equity of access, and particularly for my role, equity of student experience. But when we speak to young people about what we're doing in the schools, you know, yes, they might be a bit more aware of university, and yes, we can track, you know, how they enjoyed the programme and what they got out of it. But more important than anything, in some of the schools that we worked in, there's one where I work, for example, with Canal View Primary in Sight Hill area, feeds into Westerhales Education Centre, and up to 35% of the children at that school live in poverty. So their first thought isn't necessarily their lessons in school. They might be hungry and the school are trying to do things around that. So it's about understanding and making space for the whole person and understanding the context in which they come to their education from. So again, not problems of the pupils making. But what we had, Canal View were our school tasking winners for Edinburgh Law School this year, and we were incredibly proud of them. And the teacher fed back to me, and I can't often say this without getting emotional, and I think that's okay. I don't think we should be able to talk about children in poverty without getting at least a little bit emotional, but the school teacher told me that the pupils came back and they were so delighted with themselves, not because they won, but because they could have won something. And for them, they didn't know that was possible. They didn't know that that was something that people like them could do. And I think that's where, yes, we need the data. It's incredibly important. We have to measure the problems and the successes. I think listening to the narrative that goes alongside that, you know, I can get law firms to fund things through narrative way more than showing them figures and data. But anyone who knows me knows I'll do this all day, so I'll mute.
Well, thank you for that, Lindsay. That's actually a really, really interesting insight into the importance of this and maybe how we should think about young people and what they might achieve. There's a question here from Tom Jameson who asks for a rough indication of the participant costs involved in joining the programmes. Probably worth just asking the three of you about that, if there is a cost, what it is, because I suppose that will be in people's minds. Victoria, what's the situation with Gen Plus?
It's been funded through philanthropic money for the pilot, so the development of the program, the big investment in the technology in the program, and then the schools we'd like some other funding, I guess it would be fair to say, and that's part of our measuring impact evaluation. Is very important for that, actually, looking at tracking young people throughout and what impact does that make. And I think that's important with these initiatives. Again, there's different ways to measure that, and actually but for looking for kind of long-term funding, that is important for what we're doing. And we're then looking at a charging model to use after this pilot phase. It's not, technology is not cheap, so, but at the same time, we're able to sort of look at having a cost between £5 and £10 per pupil, and the teacher programs are just in with that anyway. So it's based on the school role, really, and that's the sort of annual cost. But we're not charging at the moment, but those conversations are happening around those.
Okay, Ian, what's the situation at Dollar?
Yeah, so all the feeder content and courses and provision are completely free to the user, whether that's a teacher, a school, or an individual. Part of that is we've been able to do that partly through a bit of philanthropic giving to get us up and going and build a platform. And then the I guess the ongoing piece around that has been back to reimagining Dollar as a charity and using some of the charitable funds to run the school, but also run the feeder, and you know, leveraging some of the successful independent school stuff to, instead of building another AstroTurf, to actually build something that is going to benefit more people than 22 people on a hockey pitch.
Okay, and Ali, last.
Yeah, school tasking is also free to all schools who want to participate. And the universities, as I say, tend to be funding it from widening participation budgets. So, like I said, we try to keep the costs really low. When the children are moving around the country, we have a little bit of sponsorship money from Adelshaw Goddard, who are wonderful and supporting the project to a great extent, getting their lawyers involved as well. And we also, as I say, we're going to be paying to get the kids down to Warwick. So we want to make it as accessible as possible. The schools that we work with can't afford to join in if it's not free for the children who are essentially getting the most benefit from it. So it's free, and we're all scrambling around to get the money to pay for it. Which is, like, it's how universities work, isn't it?
Well, and think tanks for that matter. It's 3 o'clock, but just before we finish, a question from Scott Wortley, who says, it was notable from the presentations that the different models are to an extent targeting different age groups. How important was that in the development of each of the projects? Ali, what would you say about your approach?
Yeah, well, as I say, I mean, this started from me wanting to do more with our primary school kids. We did work with Warwick's excellent at working with younger kids in outreach. We do more than most, but I felt we weren't doing enough. And I felt sometimes primary outreach work can be a little bit dry. It can be a little bit complex for the age of the kids. So we wanted something that was really immediate, simple, engaging, and that just would want them, you know, they're excited that we come in because it's a competition and they're excited to get on with the competition and see how far they can get. So the age was important from the perspective of my aim was to work more and to a greater extent with our primary school kids. But like I say, I think outreach needs to start then anyway. I think you need to get, we work with year five, so they're 9 to 10. You need to be planting that seed at that point before they get to the point where they think, no, university is not for me. I'm, you know.
Yeah.
So yes, it was important and Ian, development of the project. Yeah.
Absolutely. Ian, you're at the higher end of the age range, I guess, if it's exams and university accredited courses.
Yeah, so I mean, of the 17 courses, I would say the majority of them are actually kind of intergenerational, and they were designed so that you could have younger learners working with bigger, older learners. I mean, one is around building an intergenerational play space so young people can design and build out a play park that they can go and swing on with their granny or granddad. So there's a spread of ages, but the sustainability diploma stuff, the direct accreditation with uni, that's a kind of 16 plus qualification. So there's a spread at FIDA.
Okay, and Victoria, you're muscling in the middle, I guess.
Yeah, I know. Partly because there's less exam pressure and things around that age group in the BGE. We thought that was a good place to be. But there's lots of studies looking at how fundamental this 9 to 14-year-old age range is for establishing good practice, this foundation of learning that's going to enable them to be successful later on, and how important it is we get that right. And actually, primary schools are pretty good at developing meta skills in young people. And then there's the higher national qualifications have meta skills in them as well. So there was a gap, actually. And we thought, well, that's a really good place to get alongside young people, particularly supporting the very difficult transition from primary to senior, which can be a really tough time for kids. As this sort of, so a lot of the primary work we're doing is looking at kind of skills for transition. So communication, how do you ask for help, how do you speak to new people, and try and support young people to feel more confident as they make that move into the young people, into their next school and that transition point.
Okay, well, thank you very much to the three of you for giving us your time today. I'm sure everyone on this call wishes you great success. There's some extraordinary things going on, some extraordinary potential for growth and development, and I think, you know, most of us would be happy to see these projects in our children's schools or being used by our children's schools if they aren't already. We could talk for a while about this, and maybe we'll come back to it in due course, but thank you again for coming, and thanks to everyone else for joining us. I hope you found it worthwhile and stimulating, and as I say, as inspiring as I have in my dealings with all these people, and we shall watch on with great interest to see where this all ends up. So thanks again.
Thanks for having us, Chris.